the smooth shine of her brown skin, her artistically braided hair. But he moved on. Yes, men are hunters by nature, he was thinking. He was off in his own world again. Faithful husbands were oh so careful and furtive with their looks. Fresh-eyed boys of 11 and 12 appeared very innocent and playful. Grandfathers pretended to be above the fray and were just cute with their affection. But Casanova knew they were all watching, constantly selecting, obsessed with mastering the hunt from puberty to the grave. It was a biological necessity, no? He was quite certain of that. Women nowadays were demanding that men accept the fact that their female biological clocks were ticking. Well, with men, it was their biological cocks that were ticking. Constantly ticking, those cocks. That was a fact of nature, too. Everywhere he went, at virtually any time of day or night, he could feel the pulsing beat inside. Tick-cock, 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 tick-cock. A beautiful honey-blonde co-ed sat cross-legged on the grass, intersecting his path. She was reading a paperback, Carl Jaspers' Philosophy of Existence. The rock group Smashing Pumpkins was contributing mantra-like riffs from a portable CD player. Casanova smiled to himself. Tick-cock. The hunt was relentless for him. He was Priapus for the 90s. The difference between him and so many gutless modern men was that he acted on his natural impulses. He relentlessly searched out a great beauty, and then he took her. What an outrageously simple idea. What a compellingly modern horror story. He watched two petite Japanese co-eds chowing down on greasy North Carolina barbecue from the new Crook's Corner 2 restaurant in Durham. They looked so delicious eating their dinner, wolfing their barbecue like small animals. North Carolina barbecue consisted of pork cooked over a fire, seasoned with a vinegar-laced sauce, then finely chopped. You couldn't eat barbecue without slaw and hush puppies. He smiled at the unlikely scene. Yum. Still, he moved on. Sights and scenes caught his eye. Pierced eyebrows, tattooed ankles, Lollapalooza t-shirts, lovely flowing breasts, legs, thighs, everywhere he looked. He finally came to a small Gothic-style building near the Duke University Hospital, North Division. This was a special annex where terminally ill cancer patients from all over the South were cared for during their final days. His heart began to pound, and a series of small tremors shook his body. There she was. Chapter 10. There was the most beautiful woman in the South. Beautiful in all ways. Not only was she physically desirable, she was extremely smart. She might be able to understand him. Maybe she was as special as he was. He almost said the words out loud, and believed them to be absolutely true. He had done a great deal of homework on his next victim. Blood began to pump and rush into his forehead. He could feel a throbbing all through his body. Her name was Kate McTiernan. Katelia Margaret McTiernan, to be as precise as he liked to be. She was just walking out of the terminal cancer wing, where she had worked to help pay her way through medical school. She was all by her lonesome, as usual. Her last boyfriend had warned her that she was going to end up a beautiful old maid. Fat chance of that. Obviously, it was Kate McTiernan's decision to be alone as much as she was. She could have been with nearly anyone she chose. She was stunningly beautiful, highly intelligent, and compassionate, from what he could tell so far. Kate was a grind, though. She was incredibly dedicated to her medical studies and hospital duties. Nothing was overdone about her, and he appreciated that. Her long, curly brown hair framed her narrow face nicely. Her eyes were dark blue and sparkled when she smiled. Her laugh was catchy, irresistible. She had an all-American look, but not banal. She was a hard body, but she appeared so soft and feminine. He'd watched other men hit on her, studly students, and even the occasional jaunty and ridiculous professor. She didn't hold it against them, and he saw how she deflected them, usually with some kindness, some small generosity. But there was always that devilish, heartbreaking smile of hers. "I'm not available," it said. "You can never have me. Please don't even think about it. It's not that I'm too good for you. I'm just different." Kate the dependable, Kate the nice person, was right on time tonight. She always left the cancer annex between 7:45 and 8. She had her routines just as he did. She was a first-year intern at North Carolina University Hospital in Chapel Hill, but she'd been working in a co-op program at Duke since January. The experimental cancer ward. He knew all about Catalia McTiernan. She was going to be 31 in a few weeks. She'd had to work 3 years to pay for college and medical school expenses. She had also spent 2 years with a sick mother in Buck, West Virginia. She walked at a determined pace along Flowers Drive toward the multi-level medical center parking garage. He had to move quickly to keep up with her, all the while watching her long, shapely legs, which were a little too pale for his liking. "No time for sun, Kate? Afraid of a little melanoma?" She carried thick medical volumes against one hip. Looks and brains. She planned to practice back in West Virginia, where she was born. Didn't seem to care about making a lot of money. What for? So she could own 10 pairs of black high-topped sneakers? Kate McTiernan was wearing her usual university garb— a crisp white med school jacket, khaki shirt, weathered tan trousers, her faithful black sneakers. It worked for her. Kate the character, slightly off-center, unexpected. Strangely, powerfully alluring. On Kate McTiernan, almost anything would have worked, even the most homespun interpretation of cheap chic. He particularly loved Kate McTiernan's irreverence toward university and hospital life, and especially the holier-than-thou medical school. It showed in the way she dressed, the casual way she carried herself now, everything about her lifestyle. She seldom wore makeup, she seemed very natural, and there was nothing phony or stuck up about her that he'd noticed yet. There was even a little of the unexpected klutz in her. Earlier in the week, he had seen her flush the deepest red after she tripped on a guardrail outside Perkins' library and crashed into a bench with her hip. That warmed him tremendously. He could be touched, could feel human warmth. He wanted Kate to love him. He wanted to love her back. That was why he was so special, so different. It was what separated him from all the other one-dimensional killers and butchers he had ever heard or read about. And he had read everything on the subject. He could feel everything. He could love. He knew that. Kate said something amusing to a 40-ish-looking professor as she walked past him. Casanova couldn't hear it from where he was watching. Kate turned for some quick repartee, but kept on walking, leaving the professor with her luminous smile to think about. He saw a little jiggle action as Kate whirled around after her brief interchange with the prof. Her breasts weren't too large or too small. Her long brown hair was thick and wavy, shiny in the early evening light, revealing just a touch of red. Perfect in every detail. He had been watching her for more than 4 weeks, and he knew she was the one. He could love Dr. Kate McTiernan more than all the others. He believed it for a moment. He ached to believe it. He said her name softly. Kate. Dr. Kate. Tick-tock. Chapter 11. Samson and I took shifts at the wheel in the 4-hour haul from Washington down into North Carolina. While I drove, the man mountain slept. He wore a black T-shirt that bluntly said, "Security." Economy of words. When Samson was at the controls of my ancient Porsche, I put on a set of old Koss headphones, listened to Big Joe Williams, thought about Scoochie, continued to feel hollowed out. I couldn't sleep. hadn't slept more than an hour the night before. I felt like a grief-stricken father whose only daughter was missing. Something seemed wrong about this case. We entered the South at noon. I had been born around 100 miles away, in Winston-Salem. I hadn't been back there since I was 10 years old, the year my mother died and my brothers and I were moved to Washington. I'd been to Durham before, for Naomi's graduation. She had finished Duke undergraduate summa cum laude, and she received one of the loudest, cheeriest ovations in the history of the ceremony. The Cross family had been there in full force. It was one of the happiest, proudest days for all of us. Naomi was the only child of my brother Aaron, who died of cirrhosis at 33. Naomi had grown up fast after his death. Her mother had to work a 60-hour week for years to support them, so Naomi was in charge of the house from around the time she was 10. She was the littlest general. She was a precocious little girl, and read about Alice's adventures in Through the Looking Glass when she was only 4. A family friend gave her violin lessons, and she played well. She loved music and still played whenever she had time. She graduated number 1 in her class at John Carroll High School in D.C. As busy as she was with her studies, she found time to write graceful prose on what life was like growing up in the projects. She reminded me of a young Alice Walker. Gifted. Very special. Missing for more than 4 days. The welcome mat wasn't out for us at Durham's brand-new police headquarters building, not even after Sampson and I showed our badges and IDs from Washington. The desk sergeant wasn't impressed. He looked like something like the TV weatherman Willard Scott. He had a full crew cut, long, thick sideburns, and skin the color of fresh ham. After he found out who we were, it got a little worse. No red carpet, no southern hospitality, no southern comfort. Samson and I got to sit and cool our heels in the duty room of the Durham Police Department. It was all shiny glass and polished wood. We received the kind of hostile looks and blank stares usually reserved for drug dealers caught around grade schools. "Feel like we just landed on Mars," Samson said, as we waited and watched Durham's finest, watched complainants come and go. "Don't like the feeling I get from the Martians. Don't like their beady little Martian eyes. Don't think I like the New South." "You think about it, we'd fit in the same anywhere," I told Samson. "We'd get the same reception, same cold stares at Nairobi police headquarters." "Maybe," Samson nodded behind his dark glasses. "But at least they'd be black Martians. At least they'd know who John Coltrane is." Durham detectives Nick Ruskin and Davy Sykes finally came down to see us 1.25 hours after we arrived. Ruskin reminded me a little of Michael Douglas in his dark hero cop roles. He wore a coordinated outfit, green and tan tweed jacket, stone-washed jeans, yellow pocket tee. He was about my height, which would make him 6'3" or so, a little bigger than life. His long, brownish hair was slicked back and razor-cut. Davy Sykes was well-built. His head was a solid block that made sharp right angles with his shoulders. He had sleepy, oatmeal-brown eyes, almost no effect that I could discern. Sykes was a sidekick type, definitely not the leader, at least not if first appearances meant anything. The two detectives shook hands with us and acted as if all were forgiven, as if they were forgiving us for intruding. I had the feeling that Ruskin especially was used to getting his way inside the Durham PD. He seemed like the local star, the main man around these parts, matinee idol at the Durham triplex.
"Sorry about the wait, Detective Cross, Sampson. It's been busy as a son of a bitch around here," Nick Ruskin said.
He had a light southern accent, lots of confidence in himself. He hadn't mentioned Naomi by name yet. Detective Sykes was silent, didn't say a word.
"You two like to take a ride with Davy and me? I'll explain the situation on the way. There's been a homicide. That's what's had us all tied up. Police found a woman's body out in Effland. This is a real bad one." Chapter 12. This is a real bad one. A woman's body in F-land. What woman? Samson and I followed Ruskin and Sykes out to their car, a forest green Saab turbo. Ruskin got in the driver's seat. I remembered Sergeant Esterhaus's words in Hill Street Blues. Let's be careful out there. You know anything at all about the murdered woman? I asked Nick Ruskin as we headed on to West Chapel Hill Street. He had his siren screaming, and he was already driving fast. He drove with a kind of brashness and cockiness.
I don't know enough, Ruskin said. That's a problem, Davies and mine, with this investigation. We can't get straight dick information about much of anything. That's probably why we're in such a good mood today, you notice?
Yeah, we noticed, Samson said. I didn't look over at him. I could feel the steam rising in the back seat, though, heat coming off his skin.
Davy Sykes glanced back and frowned at Samson. I got the feeling they weren't going to become best buddies.
Ruskin continued talking. He seemed to like the spotlight, being on the big case.
This entire case is under the control of the FBI now. The DEA got in the act, too. I wouldn't be surprised if the CIA was part of the crisis team. They did send some kinky crackerjack down from their fancy outpost in Sanford.
What do you mean, this entire case? I asked Ruskin. Warning alarms were sounding in my head. I thought of Naomi again. This is a real bad one.
Ruskin turned around quickly and looked at me. He had penetrating blue eyes, and they seemed to be sizing me up.
Understand, we're not supposed to tell you anything. We're not authorized to bring you out here, either.
I hear what you're saying, I said. I appreciate the help.
Once again, Davy Sykes turned and looked at us. I felt as if Samson and I were on the other team, looking over the line of scrimmage, waiting for the ball snap, the crunch of bodies.
We're on our way to the third murder site, Ruskin went on. I don't know who the victim is. Goes without saying that I hope the victim isn't your niece.
What's this case all about? Why all the mystery? Samson asked. He sat forward in his seat.
We're all cops here. Talk straight to us.
The Durham homicide detective hesitated before he answered.
A few women, let's say several, have disappeared in a three-county area, Durham, Chatham, and Orange, which you're in now. The press has reported a couple of disappearances and two murders so far. Unrelated murders.
Don't tell me the media is actually cooperating with an investigation, I said.
Ruskin half smiled.
Not in your wildest wet dreams. They only know what the FBI's decided to tell them. Nobody's actually withholding information, but nothing's being volunteered, either.
You mentioned that several young women have disappeared, I said. How many exactly? Tell me about them.
Ruskin talked out of the side of his mouth.
We believe 8 to 10 women are missing, all young, late teens and early 20s, all students in college or high school. Only 2 bodies have been found, though. The one we are going to see could make 3. All the bodies were discovered in the last 5 weeks. The Phoebes think we're in the middle of what could be one of the worst kidnapping and murder sprees ever in the South.
How many FBI in town? Samson asked. Squad? Battalion?
They're here in full force. They have evidence that the disappearances extend beyond state lines. Virginia, South Carolina, Georgia, down into Florida. They think our friendly squirrel abducted a Florida State cheerleader at this year's Orange Bowl. They call him the Beast of the Southeast. It's as if he's invisible. He's in control of the situation right now. Calls himself Casanova. Believes he's a great lover.
Did Casanova leave mash notes at the murder scenes? I asked Ruskin.
Just at the last one. He seems to be coming out of his shell.
He wants to communicate now, bond with us. He told us he was Casanova.
Were any of the victims black women? I asked Ruskin.
One trait of repeat killers was that they tended to choose their victims along racial grounds, all white, all black, all Spanish. Not too much mixing, as a rule.
One other missing girl is black, student from North Carolina Center University. Two bodies we found were white. All the women who've disappeared are extremely attractive. We have a bulletin board up with pictures of the missing girls. Somebody gave the case a name. Beauties and the Beast. It's on the board in big letters, right over the pictures. That's another handle we have for the case.
Does Naomi Cross fit this pattern? Sampson asked quietly. Whatever the crisis team has established so far.
Nick Ruskin didn't answer right away. I couldn't tell if he was thinking about it or just trying to be considerate.
Is Naomi's picture on the FBI bulletin board, the Beauties and the Beast board? I asked Ruskin.
Yes, it is.
Davy Sykes finally spoke.
Her picture is on the big board.
Chapter 13. Don't let this be Scoochie. Her life is just beginning, I silently prayed as we sped to the homicide scene.
Terrible, unspeakable things happened all the time nowadays to all kinds of innocent, unsuspecting people. They happened in virtually every big city and even small towns, in villages of 100 or less. But most often these violent, unthinkable crimes seem to happen in America.
Ruskin downshifted hard as we curled around a steep curve and saw flashing red and blue lights. Cars and EMS vans loomed up ahead, solemnly gathered at the edge of thick pine woods. A dozen vehicles were parked haphazardly along the side of the two-lane state road. Traffic was sparse out there in the heart of nowhere. There was no buildup of ambulance chasers yet.
Ruskin pulled in behind the last car in line, a dark blue Lincoln Town car that might as well have had Federal Bureau written all over it.
A state-of-the-art homicide scene was already in progress. Yellow tape had been strung from pine trees, cordoning off the perimeter. Two EMS ambulances were parked with their blunt noses pointed into a stand of trees. I was swept into a near out-of-body experience as I floated from the car, my vision tunneled. It was almost as if I had never visited a crime scene before. I vividly remembered the worst of the Sonogy case, a small child found near a muddy river. Horrifying memories mixed with a terrifying present moment. Don't let this be Scoochie.
Sampson held my arm loosely as we followed Detectives Ruskin and Sykes. We walked for nearly a mile into the dense woods. In the heart of a copse of towering pines, we finally saw the shapes and silhouettes of several men and a few women. At least half of the group were dressed in dark business suits. It was as if we had come upon some impromptu camping trip for an accounting firm, or a coven of big-city lawyers or bankers. Everything was eerie, quiet, except for the hollow popping of the technicians' cameras. Close-up photos of the entire area were being taken. A couple of the crime scene professionals were already wearing translucent rubber gloves, looking for evidence, taking notes on spiral pads. I had a creepy, otherworldly premonition that we were going to find Scoochie now. I pushed it, shoved it away, like the unwanted touch of an angel or god. I turned my head sharply to one side, as if that would help me avoid whatever was coming up ahead.
FBI, for sure, Sampson muttered softly. Out here on the wilderness trail.
It was as if we were walking toward a mammoth nest of buzzing hornets. They were standing around, whispering secrets to one another. I was acutely aware of leaves crumpling under my feet, of the noise of twigs and small branches breaking. I wasn't really a policeman here. I was a civilian. We finally saw the naked body, at least what was left of it. There was no clothing visible at the murder scene. The woman had been tied to a small sapling with what appeared to be a thick leather bond. Sampson sighed.
Oh, Jesus, Alex.
Chapter 14. Who is the woman? I asked softly as we came up to the unlikely police group, the
multi-jurisdictional mess, as Nick Ruskin had described it. The dead woman was white. It was impossible to tell too much more than that about her at this time. Birds and animals had been feasting on her, and she almost didn't look human anymore. There were no fixed, staring eyes, just dark sockets, like burn marks. She didn't have a face. The skin and tissue had been eaten away.
"Who the hell are these two?"
one of the FBI agents, a heavy-set blonde woman in her early 30s, asked Ruskin. She was as unattractive as she was unpleasant, with puffy red lips and a bulbous, hooked nose. At least she'd spared us the usual FBI happy camper smile, or the FBI's famous smiling handshake. Nick Ruskin was brusque with her, his first endearing moment for me.
"This is Detective Alex Cross and his partner, Detective John Sampson. They're down here from D.C. Detective Cross's niece is missing from Duke. She's Naomi Cross. This is Special Agent in Charge, Joyce Kinney." He introduced the agent to us. Agent Kinney frowned, or maybe it was a scowl.
"Well, this is certainly not your niece here," she said. "I'd appreciate it if the two of you would return to the cars. Please do that."
She felt the need to go on.
"You have no authority on this case, and no right to be here, either."
"As Detective Ruskin just told you, my niece is missing." I spoke softly but firmly to Special Agent Joyce Kinney. "That's all the authority I need. We didn't come down here to admire the leather interior and instrument panel of Detective Ruskin's sports car." A thick-chested blonde man in his late 20s briskly stepped up beside his boss.
"I think you'll heard, Special Agent Kinney. I'd appreciate it if you leave now," he announced.
Under different circumstances, his over-the-top response might have been funny. Not today. Not at this massacre scene. "No way you're going to stop us," Sampson said to the blonde agent in his darkest, grimmest voice. "Not you. Not your dapper Dan friends here."
"That's fine, Mark," Agent Kinney turned to the younger man. "We'll deal with this later," she said.
Agent Mark backed off, but not without a major league scowl, much like the one I'd gotten from his boss. Both Ruskin and Sykes laughed as the agent backed down. We were allowed to stay with the FBI and the local police contingent at the crime scene. Beauties and the Beast. I remembered the phrase Ruskin had used in the car. Naomi was up on the Beast board. Had the dead woman been on the board as well? It had been hot and humid, and the body was decomposing rapidly. The woman had been badly attacked by forest animals, and I hoped that she was already dead before they came. Somehow, I didn't think so. I noted the unusual position of the body. She was lying on her back. Both her arms appeared to have been dislocated, perhaps as she twisted and struggled to free herself from the leather bonds and the tree behind her. It was as vicious a sight as I had ever seen on the streets of Washington or anywhere else. I felt almost no relief that it wasn't Naomi. I eventually talked up one of the FBI's forensic people. He knew a friend of mine at the Bureau, Kyle Craig, who worked out of Quantico in Virginia. He told me that Kyle had a summer house in the area. "This shitheel's real savvy, real smooth, if nothing else," the FBI forensic guy liked to talk. "He hasn't left pubic hair, semen, or even traces of perspiration on either of the victims I've examined. I surely doubt if we'll find much here to give us a DNA profile. At least he didn't eat her himself." "Does he have sex with the victims?" I asked before the agent went on a tangent about his experiences with cannibalism.
"Yeah, he does. Somebody had repeated sex with them. Lots of vaginal bruises and tears. Bugger's well equipped, or uses something large to simulate sex. But he must wear a cellophane body bag when he does it. Or he dusts them somehow. No pubes, no trace of body fluid yet. The forensic entomologist has already collected his samples. He'll be able to give us the exact time of death." "This could be Biddy Ann Ryerson," one of the gray-haired FBI agents within earshot said. "There was a missing person report on her. Blonde-haired gal, 5'6", about 110 pounds, wearing a gold Seiko when she disappeared. Drop-dead gorgeous. At least she used to be. Mother of two kids, said one of the female agents. Graduate English student at North Carolina State. I interviewed her husband, who's a professor. Met her two children. Beautiful little kids. 1 and 3 years old. God damn this bastard. The agent started to choke up. I could see the wristwatch, and the ribbon that tied back her hair had come undone and rested on her shoulder. She was no longer beautiful. What was left of her was bloated and suffused. The odor of decomposition was pungent, even out in the open air. The empty sockets seemed to be staring up into a crescent-shaped opening at the tops of the pine trees, and I wondered what her eyes had looked at last. I tried to imagine Casanova cavorting around in these deep, dark woods before we had arrived. I took a guess that he was in his 20s or 30s and physically strong. I was afraid for Scoochie. More than I had been, in fact. Casanova, the world's greatest lover. God save us. Chapter 15. It was well past 10 o'clock, and we were still at the grisly, highly disturbing murder scene. The dazzling amber headlights of official cars and emergency vehicles were used to illuminate a foot-worn path into the shadowy woods. It was getting colder outside. The chill night wind was a gritty slap in the face. The corpse still hadn't been moved. I watched the Bureau's technicians dutifully strip-search the woods, collecting forensic clues and taking measurements. The immediate area had been cordoned off, but I made a sketch in the dim light and took my own preliminary notes. I was trying to remember what I could about the original Casanova, 18th-century adventurer, writer, libertine. I had read parts of his memoirs somewhere along the line. Beyond the obvious, why had the killer chosen the name? Did he believe that he truly loved women? Was this his way of showing it? We could hear a bird somewhere let out an unearthly scream, and also the sounds of small animals all around us. Nobody thought of Bambi in these woods, not under the circumstances of the gruesome murder. Between 10:30 and 11, we heard a loud roar like thunder in the eerie woods. Nervous eyes looked up into the blue-black sky. "There's a familiar old tune," Samson said as he saw the fluttering lights of an incoming helicopter approaching from the northeast. "Probably Metaflight finally coming for the body," I said. A dark blue helicopter with gold stripes finally swirled down onto the blacktop highway. Whoever was piloting the copter in was a real pro. "Not Metaflight," Samson said. "More likely be Mick Jagger. Big stars traveling copters like that one." Joyce Kinney and the regional bureau director were already headed back to the highway. Samson and I followed along like uninvited pests. We received another rude shock right away. Both of us recognized the tall, balding, distinguished-looking man who stepped from the helicopter.
"Now, what the hell is he doing down here?" Samson said.
I had the same question, the same uneasy reaction. It was the deputy director of the FBI. The number two man, Ronald Burns. Burns was a real hummer inside the bureau, a big-time cage-rattler. We both knew Burns from our last multi-jurisdictional case. He was supposed to be political, a bad guy inside the bureau. But he had never been that way with me. After he had looked at the body, he asked to speak to me. It was getting stranger and stranger down in Carolina. Burns wanted to hold our little talk away from the big ears and small minds of his own people. "Alex, I'm sorry to hear your niece might have been kidnapped. I hope that isn't the case," he said. "Since you're down here, maybe you can help us out."
"Can I ask why you're down here?" I said to Burns.
Might as well skip right to the $64,000 question. Burns smiled, showing off his capped, very white front teeth.
"I do wish you had accepted our offer of that VICAP position."
I had been offered a job as a liaison between the Bureau and the D.C. police after the Sonergy kidnapping case. Burns was one of the men who interviewed me. "I like directness more than anything in a senior officer,"
Burns continued. I was still waiting for an answer to my direct question. "I can't tell you as much as you'd like to hear," Burns finally said. "I will tell you that we don't know if your niece was taken by this sick Johnny. He leaves very little physical evidence, Alex. He's careful, and he's good at what he does."
"So I've heard.
Leads us into some obvious areas for suspects. Policemen, army vets, amateurs who study the police. That could be misdirection on his part, though. Maybe he wants us to think that way."
Burns nodded.
"I'm here because this has become a high-priority mess. It's large, Alex. I can't tell you why at this time. It's classified large."
Spoken like a true FBI honcho. Mysteries wrapped in more mysteries.
Burns sighed. "I will tell you one thing. We believe that he might be a collector. We think he could be keeping a few of the young women nearby. A private harem, maybe. His very own harem."
It was a scary, startling idea. It also gave me hope that Naomi might still be alive.
"I want to be in on this," I told Burns, holding eye contact with him. "Why don't you tell me everything?"
I gave him my terms.
"I need to see the whole picture before I start giving out any theories. Why does he reject some of the women, if that's what he's doing?" "Alex, I can't tell you any more right now. I'm sorry."
Burns shook his head and half-closed his eyes for a second. I realized that he was exhausted.
"But you wanted to see how I would react to your collector theory?"
"I did," Burns admitted, and finally had to smile.
"A modern-day harem would be possible, I guess. It's a common enough male fantasy," I told him. "Strangely, it's a prevalent female fantasy, too. Don't rule that out yet."
Burns catalogued what I'd said and left it at that. He asked me to help again, but was unwilling to tell me everything he knew. He finally walked back to be with his own people. Samson came up beside me.
"What did his rigidness have to say? What brings him to this unholy forest with us mere mortals?"
"He said something interesting. Said that Casanova might be a collector, maybe creating his own private harem somewhere near here," I told Samson. "He said the case is large," his choice of words.
Large meant it was a very bad case, probably worse than it already seemed. I wondered how that could be, and I almost didn't want to know the answer.
Chapter 16. Kate McTiernan was lost in an odd but nicely illuminating thought. "When the strike of a hawk breaks the body of its prey," she considered, "it's only because of timing." That was the insight from her latest kata in black belt class. Exquisite timing was everything in karate, and also in so many other things. It also helped if you could bench press almost 200 pounds, which she could. Kate dawdled along, busy, funky, rambunctious Franklin Street in Chapel Hill. The street ran north and south, bordering the picturesque campus of the University of North Carolina. She passed bookstores, pizza shops, rollerblade rentals, Ben and Jerry's ice cream. The rock group White Zombie was blaring from the ice cream store. Kate wasn't a dawdler by nature, but the evening was warm and pleasant, so she stopped to window shop for a change. The college town crowd was familiar, friendly, and very comfortable. She loved her life here, first as a medical student and now as an intern. She never wanted to leave Chapel Hill, never wanted to go back and be a doctor in West Virginia. But she would go. It was her promise to her mother, just before Beadsy McTiernan died. Kate had given her word, and her word was good. She was old-fashioned about things like that. A small-town mensch. Kate's hands were thrust into the deep pockets of a slightly wrinkled hospital medical jacket. She thought that her hands were her bad feature. They were gnarled, and she had no fingernails to speak of. There were two reasons for that: her job as slave labor at the cancer ward, and her avocation as a second-degree black belt, a Nidan. It was the one tension releaser she allowed herself. Karate class was her R&R. The name pin on the upper left pocket of her jacket said, K. McTiernan, M.D. She liked the tiny irreverence of wearing that symbol of status and prestige with her baggy pants and the sneakers. She didn't want to seem like a rebel, and she really wasn't, but she needed to keep some small individuality inside the large hospital community. Kate had just picked up a paperback copy of Cormac McCarthy's All the Pretty Horses at the Intimate Bookshop. First-year interns weren't supposed to have time to read novels, but she made time. At least, she promised to make time tonight. The late April night was so fine, so perfect in every way, that Kate considered stopping off at Spanky's on the corner of Columbia and Franklin. She might sit at the bar and just read her book. There was absolutely no way she would let herself meet somebody on a school night, which meant most nights for her. She usually had Saturdays off, but by then she was too bush to deal with pre- and post-mating rituals. It had been that way ever since she and Peter McGrath had severed their on-again-off-again relationship. Peter was 38, a doctor of history, and close to brilliant. He was handsome as sin, and way too self-absorbed for her taste. The breakup had been messier than she had expected. They weren't even friends now. It had been 4 months without Peter now, pun intended. Not good, but not in the top 10 worst things she'd had to deal with. And besides, she knew the breakup was really her fault and not Peter's. Breaking up with lovers was a problem she had. It was part of her secret past. Secret present? Secret future? Kate McTiernan raised her wristwatch to her face. It was a funky Mickey Mouse model that her sister Carol Ann had given her, and it was a swell little timekeeper. It was also a reminder to herself, never get a big head because you're a doctor now. Damn. Her farsightedness was getting worse. At almost 31 years old. She was an old lady. She'd been the grand dam of the University of North Carolina Medical School. It was already 9:30, past her bedtime. Kate decided to pass on Spanky's and head back to the hacienda. She'd heat up some fourth-degree chili and maybe have hot chocolate with about an inch topping of marshmallow fluff. Curling up in bed with some junk food, Cormac McCarthy, and maybe R.E.M. didn't sound half bad, actually. Like many of the students at Chapel Hill, as opposed to the wealthier crowd up Tobacco Road at Duke, Kate had a major cash flow problem. She lived in a three-room apartment that was the top floor of a frame house, a North Carolina country house. All the paint was peeling, and the house looked as if it were molting. It was at the ass end of Pittsboro Street in Chapel Hill. She had gotten a good deal on the rent. The first thing she had noticed about the neighborhood were the exquisite trees. They were old and stately hardwoods, not pines. Their long branches reminded her of the arms and fingers of wizened old women. She called her street Old Lady's Lane. Where else would the old lady of the medical school live? Kate arrived home at about 9:45. Nobody was living downstairs in the house that she rented from a widowed lady who lived in Durham. "I'm home. It's me, Kate," she called to the family of mice who lived somewhere behind the refrigerator. She couldn't bring herself to exterminate them. "Did you miss me? You guys eat yet?" She flipped on the overhead kitchen light and listened to the irritating electric buzz that she hated. Her eyes caught the blow-up of a quote from one of her med school teachers. "Medical students have to practice humility." Well, she was definitely practicing humility. Inside her small bedroom, Kate pulled on a wrinkled black polo shirt that she never ever bothered to iron. Ironing clothes was not a priority these days. It was one reason to have a man around, though. Someone to clean, maintain, take out the trash, cook, iron. She was fond of a particular old feminist line. "A woman without a man is like a fish without a bicycle." Kate yawned, just thinking about the 16-hour day that would start for her at 5 the next morning. Damn it, she loved her life. Loved it. She fell onto the creaking double bed that was covered with plain white sheets. The only flourish was a couple of colored chiffon scarves which hung from the bedpost. She canceled her order for chili and hot chocolate with marshmallow fluff, and she set All the Pretty Horses on top of unread copies of Harper's and The New Yorker. Kate flipped off her lamp and was asleep in 5 seconds. End of wonderfully illuminating discussion with herself for the night. Kate McTiernan had no idea, no suspicion that she was being watched. that she had been followed ever since she walked down crowded, colorful Franklin Street, that she had been chosen. Dr. Kate was next. Tick-tock. Chapter 17. No, Kate thought. This is my home. She almost said it out loud, but she didn't want to make a sound. There was someone in her apartment. She was still half asleep, but she was almost sure about the intruding noise that woke her up. Her pulse was already racing. Her heart floated up into her throat. Jesus God, no. She stayed very still, huddled near the head of her bed. A few more nervous seconds passed slowly, like centuries. Not a move from her, not a breath. Bone-white slants of moonlight played across the window panes, creating eerie shadows in her bedroom. She listened to the house, listened with total concentration to every creak and crack the old building made. She didn't hear anything unusual now, but she was sure she had. The recent murders and the news stories about the kidnappings in the Research Triangle area made her fearful. "Don't be gruesome," she thought. "Don't get melodramatic." She sat up slowly in bed and listened. Maybe a window had blown open. She had better get out of bed and check the windows and doors. For the first time in 4 months, she actually missed Peter McGrath. Peter wouldn't have helped, but she would have felt safer, even with dear old Peter out. Not that she was totally frightened or vulnerable. She could hold her own with most men. She could fight like hell. Peter used to say that he pitied the man who messed with her, and he meant it. He had been a little physically afraid of her. Well, prearranged fighting in karate dojos was one thing. This was the real thing. Kate slipped silently out of bed. Not a sound. She felt the roughness and coolness of the floorboards under her bare feet. It sent a wake-up call to her brain, and she moved into a fighting stance. Whap! A gloved hand came down hard over her mouth and nose, and she thought she heard cartilage crack in her nose. Then a large and very strong male body tackled her. All of his weight was pressing her into the cool, hard floorboards, pinning her down. Athlete. Her brain was computing every bit of information. She tried to stay clear and focused. Very powerful, trained. He was cutting off her air supply. He knew precisely what he was doing. Trained. It wasn't a glove that he was wearing, she realized. It was a cloth. Thick with dampness. It was suffocating her. Was he using chloroform? No, it was odorless. Maybe ether. Halothane? Where would he get anesthetic supplies? Kate's thinking was getting fuzzy, and she was afraid she was going to black out. She had to get him off of her. Bracing her legs, she twisted her body hard to the left, and threw all of her weight away from her attacker, toward the pale, shadowy bedroom wall. Suddenly, she was out of his grasp, free. "Bad idea, Kate," he said in the darkness. He knew her name. Chapter 18. The strike of a hawk. Timing was everything. Now timing was survival, Kate understood. She tried desperately to stay alert, but the powerful drug from the dampened cloth had started to act. Kate managed a three-quarter speed sidekick, aiming at his groin. She felt something hard. Oh, shit. He was prepared for her. He had on an athlete's cup to protect his mushy genitals. He knew her strengths. Oh, God, no. How did he know so much about her? "Not nice, Kate," he whispered. "Definitely not hospitable. I know about your karate. I'm fascinated by you." Her eyes went wild. Her heart was hammering so loudly she thought he might hear it. He was scaring the living shit out of her. He was strong and fast and knew about her karate. Knew what her next move would be.
"Help me! Somebody please help!"
she shrieked as loudly as she could. Kate was just trying to scare him off with her screams. There was nobody within half a mile of the house on Old Ladies Lane. Powerful hands like claws grabbed at her and managed to catch her arm just above the wrist. Kate howled as she ripped herself away. He was more powerful than any of the advanced black belts at her karate school in Chapel Hill. Animal, Kate thought. Savage animal. Very rational and crafty. Professional athlete? The most important lesson her sensei at the dojo had taught her broke through the numbing fear and chaos of the moment. Avoid all fights. Whenever possible, run from a fight. There it was, the best of hundreds of years of experience in martial arts. Those who never fight always live to fight another day. She ran from her bedroom and down the familiar narrow, twisting hallway. Avoid all fights, run from a fight, she told herself. Run, run, run. The apartment seemed darker than usual that night. She realized that he'd closed every curtain and blind. He'd had the presence of mind, the calmness, the plan of action. She had to be better than him, better than his plan. A saying of Sun Tzu's hammered through her head. A victorious army wins its victories before seeking battle. The intruder thought exactly like Sun Tzu and her sensei. Could it be someone from her karate dojo? Kate managed to reach the living room. She couldn't see a thing. He had closed the curtains in there, too. Her vision and sense of balance were definitely way off. There were two of just about every shape and shifting shadow in the room. God damn him. God damn him. Floating in the soft, drug-induced haze, she thought of the other women who had disappeared in Orange and Durham counties. She'd heard on the news that another body had been found, a young mother of two children. She had to get out of the house. Maybe the fresh air would help to revive her. She stumbled to the front door. Something was blocking her way. He had pushed the sofa against the door. Kate was too weak to shoulder it away. In desperation, she screamed out again.
Peter! Come help me! Help, Peter!
Oh, shut up, Kate. You don't even see Peter McGrath anymore. You think he's a bloody fool. Besides, his house is 7 miles away. 7.3 miles. I checked. His voice was so calm and rational. Just another day at the office of psychopathology. And he definitely knew her, knew all about Peter McGrath, knew everything. He was somewhere close behind her in the electrifying darkness. There was no urgency or panic in his voice. This was a day at the beach for him. Kate moved quickly to her left, away from the voice, away from the human monster inside her house. Excruciating pain suddenly shot through her body, and she let out a low groan. She'd clipped her shin on the too-low, too-dumb-for-words glass table her sister Carol Ann had given her. It was Carol's well-meaning effort to class up the place. Oh, Christ, God damn it, how she hated that table. There was a shooting, throbbing pain in her left leg. Stub your toe, Kate? Why don't you stop trying to run around in the dark? He laughed, and it was such a normal-sounding laugh, almost friendly. He was enjoying himself. This was a big game for him. A boy-girl game in the dark. Who are you? She screamed at him. Suddenly, she thought, could it be Peter? Has Peter gone mad? Kate was close to passing out. The drug he had given her left her little strength to run anymore. He knew about her karate black belt. He probably knew she spent time in the weight room, too. She turned, and a bright flashlight shone right in her eyes. Blinding light was beaming at her face. He moved the flashlight away, but she still saw residual circles of light. She started to blink and could barely make out the silhouette of a tall man. He was more than 6 feet tall and had long hair. She couldn't see his face, just a glimpse of his profile. Something was wrong with his face. Why was that? What was the matter with him? Then she saw the gun.
No, don't, Kate said. Please, don't.
Yes, do, he whispered to her intimately, almost like a lover. Then he calmly shot Kate McTiernan point blank in the heart. Chapter 19. Early on Sunday morning, it got even worse on the Casanova case. I had to drive Sampson to Raleigh-Durham International Airport. He needed to be back on the job in Washington that afternoon. Someone had to protect the Capitol while I was working down here. The investigation was getting hotter and nastier now that the third woman's body had been found. Not only local police and FBI, but also field and game officials had joined in the physical search of the homicide site. Deputy Director Ronald Burns had been here last night. Why was that? Samson gave me a bear hug at the American Airlines security gate. We must have looked like a couple of Washington Redskins linebackers after they won the Super Bowl, or maybe after they didn't even get into the playoffs in 1991. I know what Naomi means to you, he whispered against the side of my skull. I know some of what you're feeling. You need me again, you call. We gave each other a quick kiss on the cheek, like Magic Johnson and Isaiah Thomas used to do before their NBA basketball games. That drew a few stares from the peanut gallery milling around the metal detectors. Samson and I love each other, and we're not ashamed to show it. Unusual for tough-as-nails men of action like the two of us. Watch out for the Fed Bureau. Watch your back with the local folk. Watch your front, too. I don't like Ruskin. I really don't like Sykes, Samson continued to give me instructions. You'll find Naomi. I've confidence in you, always have. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. The big man finally walked away and never once looked back. I was all alone down south, chasing monsters again. Chapter 20. I walked from the Washington Duke Inn to the Duke campus at around 1 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. I had just eaten a real North Carolina breakfast, a pot and a half of hot good coffee, very salty cured ham and runny eggs, biscuits and red-eye gravy, grits. I'd heard a country song playing in the dining room. One day, when you swing that skillet, my face ain't gonna be there. I was feeling crazy and on edge, so the pretty half-mile hike to the campus was good therapy. I prescribed it for myself and then listened to the doctor. The crime scene the night before had shaken me. I vividly remembered a time when Naomi was a little girl and I'd been her best friend. We used to sing Eensy Weensy Spider and Silkworm Silkworm. In a way, she'd taught me how to be friends with Janny and Damon. She had prepared me to be a pretty good father. At the time, my brother Aaron used to bring Scoochie with him to the Capri Bar on 3rd Street. My brother was busy drinking himself to death. The Capri was no place for his little girl, but somehow Naomi handled it. Even as a child, she understood and accepted who and what her father was. When she and Aaron would stop at our house, my brother would usually be high, but not really drunk yet. Naomi would be in charge of her father. He would make the effort to stay sober when she was there. The trouble was, Scoochie couldn't always be around to save him. At 1 o'clock on Sunday, I had a meeting scheduled with the Dean of Women at Duke. I went to the Allen Building, which was just off Chapel Drive. Several administration offices were housed there on the 2nd and 3rd floors. The Dean of Women was a tall, well-built man named Browning Lowell. Naomi had told me a lot about him. She considered him a close advisor and also a friend. That afternoon, I met with Dean Lowell in his cozy office that was filled with thick old books. The office looked out across Magnolia and elm-lined Chapel Drive to the Few Quad. Like everything else about the campus, the setting was visually spectacular. Gothic buildings everywhere, Oxford University in the south. "I am a fan of yours, through Naomi," Dean Lowell said as we shook hands. He had a powerful grip, which I expected from the physical look of him. Browning Lowell was well-muscled, probably in his mid-30s and good-looking. His sparkling blue eyes seemed relentlessly cheerful to me. Once upon a time, he'd been a world-class gymnast, I remembered. He had attended Duke as an undergraduate and was supposed to star for the American team in the 1980 Olympics in Moscow. In the early part of that year, an unfortunate news story had broken that Browning Lowell was gay and having an affair with a basketball player of some renown. He had left the American team even before the eventual Olympic boycott. Whether the story was true had never been proved to my knowledge. Lowell had married, though, and he and his wife now lived in Durham. I found Lowell to be sympathetic and warm. We got down to the sad business of Naomi's disappearance. He had all the right suspicions and appropriate fears about the ongoing police investigation. It seems to me that the local papers aren't making simple, logical connections between the murders and the disappearances. I don't understand that. We've alerted all the women here on campus, he told me. Duke co-eds were being asked to sign in and out of dorms, he elaborated. The buddy system was encouraged whenever students went out at night. Before I left his office, he made a phone call to Naomi's dorm house. He said it would make access a little easier, and he wanted to do everything he possibly could to help.